From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Women are excelling in almost every white-collar field as doctors, lawyers, CEOs. A woman may soon be president. But that doesn't mean their earnings look anything like their male counterparts in the same jobs. And that gap widens the higher up the economic ladder women climb. This hour on Point, women and the white-collar pay gap. You can join us on air or online. Are you making less than your male colleagues? What's your explanation? Discrimination? Are men just better negotiators? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in the hour, we'll look at women reentering the workforce after taking a break for kids and how they should explain the gap on their resumes. But first, joining me from Washington is Janet Adamy, news editor at The Wall Street Journal, where she writes about demographics. She's been writing about pay equity, and you can link to her article, Women in Elite Jobs Face Stubborn Pay Gap, at our website, onpointradio.org. Janet, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And with me from Ithaca, New York, is Francine Blau, professor of industrial and labor relations and professor of economics at Cornell University. She is co-author of the textbook, The Economics of Women, Men, and Work, and is co-author of the paper, The Gender Wage Gap, Extent, Trends, and Explanations, which you can also link at our website, onpointradio.org. Francine, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. Delighted to be here.
Well, thank you both. So, Janet, big study here, lots to dig into. Start us off with your headline about women and this stubborn pay gap.
Sure. Well, we found two things. The first thing we found was that highly educated women lag the furthest behind their male peers in pay. So if you look at women with a bachelor's degree or higher, they had the biggest gender wage gap. They earned, on average, 76% of their male peers. What was striking to us is that's exactly the opposite of what it used to be a generation ago. Back in 1980, if you had the more education you had, the narrower your pay gap would be with men within your educational group. And we were really surprised that that had flipped. We also looked specifically at occupations within, we analyzed census data looking at 450 job occupation categories, and we found notably high pay gaps in many elite jobs, specifically doctors, personal financial advisors, aircraft pilots, and judges. And I'll just give you some of the figures here for doctors, for women working full-time. They earn about 64% of their male colleagues on average, 64% of men who are in the group of physicians, personal financial advisors, they earn about 62%. So pretty wide gaps at the top.
So we'll dig into the reasons why throughout this hour. I was interested in this interactive diagram that is included in your article online that looks at pay gaps by profession and income, as you are mentioning here. Here's one. The female bank tellers earn 98% of what male bank tellers earn. And you talk about the female physicians and the surgeons earning 64% of the male physicians and surgeons. So indeed, the higher paid professions, the larger the pay gap.
We did. We found that. And there's been some research on this. Typically, often what happens in higher paid professions is that in many of them, the employees are not as interchangeable. So when women do things like take breaks to take care of kids, they often end up lagging further behind. And there's a lot of variables here, and it gets very complicated. But it is true that on average, with every step of education going up from less than a high school diploma to high school diploma to some college to college graduate, every rung of that ladder you got up, the women got further behind on average in terms of pay.
Francine Blau, you've been studying gender and pay for many years now. Janet's article is in part based on your research. How do you see this?
Well, I think that let me just first point out that we looked at it a little bit differently than Janet and got very similar conclusions. We focused on women at the 90th percentile of the female distribution, that is very top, and men at the very top of the male distribution. And we found the pay gap there was considerably larger than it was at the middle or the bottom. And that was true even in a statistical analysis where we controlled for a lot of the qualifications that we expect to influence pay, like level of education, occupation, industry, how much experience you have. So there's a substantial unexplained gap at the top. And I think Janet hit on a lot of really important reasons. Let me mention a couple more. you know, there's the old term, the glass ceiling. And I think we can't discount discrimination as a factor here. And discrimination does not have to be overt and conscious. It can be subtle and unconscious. They say, well, I just don't think this person would fit in, and things like that. So I want to interject discrimination as a factor. I don't recall if you mentioned negotiation, but we're seeing more and more about that, where women are more reluctant than men to negotiate. But they're kind of in a double bind, because research shows that when women do negotiate, they get more adverse reactions than men do, because it doesn't fit with the traditional female role. Mm.
Janet, jump back in here. Speak to those two points. First, the negotiation piece. Are you saying, did you find that women are worse negotiators?
I talked to a lot of women in these individual professions about what it was, why they think they personally fell behind. So again, physicians, financial planners, I mean, women in other professions too. And I think the number one thing I did hear was negotiation. There was a woman who worked in human resources. So again, this is a position where people are very savvy about, you know, how the workplace works, what other people in the organization are earning. She said for her first five jobs, she didn't negotiate, because oftentimes she was, you know, she was so thrilled to have the job that she, you know, the salary, it was kind of a second thought. Many women said that throughout their career, they wish they had pushed for more.
And to Francine's point of discrimination, do you see it that way? Is it discrimination? Is it, you know, this thick glass ceiling is all?
I think discrimination is such a complicated thing to measure, and Professor Blau's work has done a very good job on trying to capture this. But often what happens is that in studies, everything that isn't measurable gets lumped into one bucket, and that is sometimes seen as discrimination. When I talked to women for the story, I didn't find a lot of the smoking gun type of stuff where women said, you know, it was clear to me that, you know, this person said, well, you're a woman, you're going to make the less money. That type of stuff is, you know, the days of that, thankfully, by and large, are out of the workforce. But what I did find is women talking about how the culture of workplaces, they felt like that worked against them, particularly in finance. We found very notable gaps in finance, as I mentioned, personal financial planners. And women talked about the extent to which, you know, men just, there are more men in the field. They've had networks for longer. Those networks help them generate business. But there was also a feeling that it was still, in some ways, an old boys' club. I talked to a woman who had been a financial planner in Boston, and she was preparing to move to Louisiana to start in financial planning down there. She asked a gentleman down there that she knew, you know, what do you think? Do you think this is a good idea? And he said, well, you have three strikes against you. You're female, Yankee, and not a great golfer. So, you know, is that discrimination? I think what it speaks to is that women certainly face a climate, and particularly in certain industries, where they feel like the playing field isn't totally level.
Is part of the explanation, Janet Adamy, for this pay gap that women often pull back from work when they become mothers?
So particularly among white-collar women, there is ample research showing that they pay a very heavy penalty when they take time off to have kids. A study by Claudia Golden at Harvard University and some associates had found, it looked at University of Chicago MBAs. And right out of graduation, those women were earning about the same amount as their male peers. But you get about a decade out from there, and the women were earning about 57% of the men. And what she found was the main reason was that the women, they were working fewer hours, and they were interrupting their career primarily because of children. And that gets to what I think I mentioned earlier is a really interesting aspect of this. In professions where there is more interchangeability, so when that woman takes time off, you know, the employer can easily substitute in, those women tend to face a narrower pay gap. But in the business professions, to some extent in law, because those employees aren't as interchangeable, when they're pulling back to have kids, the employer really penalizes them, and they end up having a hard time recovering from that gap in their experience or the extent to which they fall behind in the pay scale.
Francine Blau, that's an interesting study, the Claudia Golden study, the Harvard University study, that Chicago University of Chicago MBA grads equal out of the gate, men and women, 10 years out, women are earning 57% of their male classmates.
Yes, and this is something that we see particularly in these elite occupations. So there's a similar results for lawyers, again, starting off very similarly and then falling behind. And I think it is different from other occupations in the labor force in this particularly heavy penalty. And one of the things in Claudia Golden's work that's so fascinating is the women didn't even have to take particularly much time off. You know, it could be a matter of 6 months, but any interruption. And I think it is because of the idea that you particularly have to closely service the clients. And you're, as Janet said, you're not interchangeable with other workers. Let me circle back to the discrimination idea, because I do want to be clear that I totally agree with Janet that it's difficult to measure, and I don't discount these other explanations as being part of the factor. But there has been some very interesting experimental work that suggests that discrimination plays a role. A recent study out of Yale sent actually college professors applications to evaluate for the job of laboratory manager. And they randomly assigned the sex to the identical resume, Jane and John, and the ones supposedly coming from the male got higher evaluations and higher suggested pay, interestingly. So I think a lot of these things do operate at an unconscious level, and that makes them particularly difficult to combat.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about how the more elite the job, the less women make compared to men in this country. And you can join the conversation. Do childcare responsibilities impact how women, how you are seen in the office? Hiring managers, how do you explain the inequality? Here's Rockefeller Foundation President Judith Robin interviewing Robin Wright last Tuesday. Wright spoke about asking to be paid as much as her co-star, Kevin Spacey, for the role as Claire Underwood in Netflix's House of Cards.
I was looking at statistics, and Claire Underwood's character was more popular than his for a period of time in a season, so I capitalized on that moment. And I was like, you better pay me or I'm going to go public. And they did.
My guest this hour, Janet Adame, news editor at The Wall Street Journal, whose recent article is Women in Elite Jobs Face Stubborn Pay Gap, and with Francine Blau, professor of industrial and labor relations and professor of economics at Cornell University. You mentioned this briefly, Janet, but I want to ask you again. I found it so fascinating. What was that compensation and benefit managers, women who see all the data, have a huge pay gap. They know they're getting paid less. Right?
They do. It, that was probably the biggest surprise of the whole data set that we looked at. On average, female compensation and benefits managers earn about 68% of men in that professional group, despite outnumbering the men more than 3-1. You know, to us, that really called into question this issue of how powerful transparency can be. So on the campaign trail, when you hear lawmakers talking about solutions to this, Hillary Clinton has been talking a lot about the need to increase transparency. The White House has also put forth another transparency effort where large employers are going to be asked starting next year to report salary data by gender and by race to the federal government. But we kind of stopped and stepped back from that and thought, you know, if the very people within the workplace who are setting the salaries, if their pay as a group is lagging so far behind for women, you know, what does that say about how powerful transparency actually is?
So what's the psychology behind that, Francine Blau?
Well, let me, sorry, back up here a little and be a little bit more favorable about transparency, where I agree with Janet, it's not a panacea. But when you take that differential, for example, on human resource managers, there are factors that could contribute to it that transparency doesn't help. And that is First of all, firms tend to have a hierarchy, and our occupational categories group people throughout the hierarchy, often in a particular category of manager. So it may be that part of the problem is women's lack of ability to get promoted all the way to the top there. Another is my own research has shown that even in the same occupations, men and women often do not work in the same firms. So it's a pay gap that's in the same occupational category, but as a result of having different employers. So transparency is aimed at the situation where men and women work side by side in the same firm, and it could actually be quite helpful there.
Janet Adamy, staying on this point of wage transparency, a lot of talk about requiring employers to report salary data. The White House says next year large employers must provide salary data by race and gender. Does spotlighting unequal pay spur employers to correct it in your research?
So just to get to what Professor Blau was saying, that yes, I think in general transparency is seen as a good thing, but I would agree with her. It's a good thing, but not a panacea. What the White House is asking for next year. Some folks I've spoken to about that, their criticism of that is that it creates these very broad categories of employees that people will have to report for. So it's not the kind of thing that Francine is talking about, where if you are transparent about, you know, a man and a woman working exactly in the same job side by side, you can help air out any disparities that may be unfair. The White House effort is only going to gather salaries in large groups for, I think there are about a dozen different employee groupings. So there are certainly some limitations as to what that can do.
You mentioned Hillary Clinton, Janet. She's often spoken about the importance of closing the gender wage gap. Here she is at a Q&A at the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce in October.
We cannot grow the economy and get wages rising unless we end the unequal pay that women in the workplace are still suffering under.
However, according to the Daily Caller, there is a substantial pay gap among the top executives at her own foundation, the Clinton Foundation. Three times as many men occupy the executive suites at the foundation. Top male executives earn $109,000 more than the top female executives. So I guess easy to talk about, not so easy to do. Janet?
Yeah, I read that story, and I think the I can't speak to the exact research they did. I haven't looked specifically at the foundation salary numbers, but it did look like they were basing this on a sample set of a very small number of people. I mean, I think it was around a dozen, and so without knowing exactly what jobs those women hold and those men hold, it's very hard to make an across the board conclusion about whether an organization has fairness when you're not accountable for some of the details in a very small sample set of people.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Ash Skow is with us, commentary writer for the Washington Examiner. You can link to her recent articles on gender wage gap at our website, onpointradio.org. Ash, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So how do you see this issue? Do you see a pay gap between men and women?
I don't see it as a pay gap. I see it as an earnings gap. That, as you've been talking about for the past, you know, several segments, is due more to different choices that men and women make in their careers, different careers that they take. And when we want to talk about the Daily Caller article and Hillary Clinton Foundation or the foundation and how they pay people, I mean, just look at how the guests were going to great lengths to say, oh, well, this was limited and we don't have all the information. But when it comes to anything that supports the narrative of a wage gap, then it's just taken at face value and you don't have to really point out the other factors.
So to your mind, this is not about discrimination of any kind. It is that men and women value different things in the workplace.
I think that's the biggest part. I think there are anecdotes that there is discrimination here and there, and there was certainly discrimination back in the 60s and 70s, but we live in different times now, and men and women value different things. There was just a study that came out in April that showed, that asked men and women, what do you value in a career? And men overwhelmingly said that they value money. Women overwhelmingly said that they value flexibility. They want time off. And when you work fewer hours, as Bureau of Labor Statistics continually show, women work fewer hours than men, then you're going to earn less money. That's not saying that you are making less money, that you are paid less money. I mean, you could be paid the exact same amount as the man, but if you're working fewer hours, then you're going to earn less.
You mentioned times are different now. I'm curious how this conversation fares among different age groups. Do you think millennials, for example, feel differently about this issue than maybe older women and men?
I feel they do. There was also another study that was showing that these large numbers of women have been harassed or discriminated against somehow in the workplace. But if you did an age breakdown, the women that were more likely to say they had experienced this were older women, whereas millennials were far less likely to say that they have actually experienced any of this. And if you look at other studies that come out, millennial women, especially in large cities, are actually earning more than their male counterparts. Now, of course, when they get into their 30s, they start earning less. And then, of course, what is that? What causes that? It is the other factors. It is the taking time off for having a child or raising a family, or, you know, maybe just leaving a different career, taking a less demanding career and finding something that you're more passionate about.
Janet Adamy, speak to some of Ash's points here, specifically, you know, different times, different views, even different statistics.
Well, I think the most important thing to go back to is she said, you know, if men are working more hours, they should be paid more. And I think, you know, for anyone, if you work more hours, you should be paid more for that. I think most people would agree that that's fair. But what some of the research, specifically the MBA research that we were discussing, pointed to is if you work, you know, the difference between someone working 40 hours a week and 80 hours a week, that person isn't just earning twice as much. They're earning exponentially more. There are enormous premiums in white-collar jobs for people who are willing to put in the longest hours. And so I think it's not just a question of whether, you know, whether just because the women are having to take some of these breaks for kids that you know, this is what they want and this is what they choose. I think you have to look at a system where the premiums are really quite high when you're willing to work longer hours. And then what some of the research also looks at is this necessary to have one person tethered to a job? If we made jobs more interchangeable, then would women have a better advantage in terms of the earnings gap? So, for example, one profession that's been studied is pharmacists. Pharmacists used to have a pretty notable wage gap back when they owned their own pharmacies, and, you know, they had to be there, they had to know the patients. Mm-hmm. And as pharmacy gradually has moved toward more of a profession where, you know, they're owned by chains, you're looking at the computer to figure out what the patient's, you know, history is, that pharmacists have gotten much more pay parity in the workplace as they become interchangeable.
Let's get a listener in here from Denver, Colorado. Christy is on the line. Hi, Christy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Sure, go ahead.
So I just wanted to comment on the pay gap and women and their negotiating power. And in my particular situation, I'm a laboratory manager for a facility that does both chemistry and biology. And my male counterpart is the manager over the biology side, and he makes about 20% more than I do. Mm. And my lead lab analyst below me only makes.
Christy, are you there? Did we lose you? So there's a story, a lab manager earning, 10 to 15% of what the man 20. Is, 20%, yeah, mm-hmm. of what the man is making there. A perfect example.
20% less.
Yeah, 20% less. Another example of that. Let's go to Jennifer in Boston. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air. Welcome.
Sorry. Hi. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead. Jennifer, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yes, so you had talked about how breaks affect this pay gap, and I have a personal story that can echo that, but I also know ways that can be used to mitigate it. And I am a Harvard Business School grad, and I took 9 years out to have two children, and I raised them until, you know, the youngest was in kindergarten or first grade. And I decided that, you know, I really wanted to go back to work. And actually, the entire time I was with my kids, I missed work. And it was a part of my life that you know, there was a big gap, you know, in what sort of the way I defined myself and what I wanted to give back to the world. But, you know, taking a break, you know, excuse the pun, but it doesn't have to be a deal breaker. It, you know, coming back in, when I was trying to figure out how to get back in, I took a couple of courses and, you know, they would say, you know, do this or do that. And, but the truth was that I was terrified about all these things that you have been talking about. And that is that when I got back, I wouldn't be paid as much, or I wouldn't be given a position that had any responsibility or any decision-making, you know, opportunities. And
so what'd you do? Did you get back in, Jennifer?
I did, yes.
And how's it going?
It's going great. I got reinserted in the middle level. I didn't drop down much. This is a lot of women who take breaks. They end up having to start at the very bottom again. And also, I've been compensated fairly and at parity with my male peers.
Jennifer, thanks so much for the call. What do you say to somebody like Jennifer? Janet, you know, a lot of this is in your head, right? It's kind of a head game going back in.
Well, it's a great story. I mean, it's great to hear that she was able to spend that time with her children and come back in at an equal level. I think some of the policies, some of the most interesting things from a policy standpoint are happening on the state level. States are trying to make people like Jennifer, who come into a job and get their foot in the door, to make them pay less for that prior loss of income. So there's some state bills that would prohibit employers from making it a requirement of getting a job to ask what your salary is. You know, so what were you making the last time, in your last job? Oftentimes what happens to women is that, you know, they're willing to take a, you know, a 10 or 20% bump with every job. But if that's a little bit less each time than they should have gotten along the way, that's part of what's putting them behind. So some of those state laws could actually be very helpful to somebody like Jennifer once she gets her foot back in the door. If an employer is not going to be pressing her about her salary history, and they may be just, you know, giving her the salary that the job deserves, then she may be at a little bit more of an advantage.
Ashkow, jump back in here. What did you hear in Jennifer's story, and are there any legislative changes you'd make based on your viewpoint of this?
Well, I think her story was great, that she stood up for herself and she made sure that, you know, she wasn't taken advantage of. And that's, you know, one of those things that women need to be prepared to do that and to know your worth. Mika Brzezinski's book was great, Knowing Your Worth, and, you know, knowing that you do deserve this, and also accepting. I mean, 9 years is a long time. I mean, 9 years is a long time to take out of the workforce. So expecting to be at the same level as you were when you left, when technology has moved so much during that time, when even what she was making back then versus what she would need to be making right now to be at the same level due to inflation and everything would be completely different. And again, she didn't need the government's help for this. She did it on her own, and that's kind of an example of we don't always have to go running to government for these things.
Ashkow, commentary writer for the Washington Examiner. Ash, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Let's go to one more call here. Shu in Boston. Hi, Shu. Welcome to the program. Got about 30 seconds here.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Fran. I just want you to know that I've been recently looking at the salaries. I'm an economist also, and looking at the salaries of academic women or women in science in general. And I was looking at women in biomedicine. So on average, in all sectors, there's about a 12% gap of people with PhDs. And I can explain away all but about 5% using things like GAPS. So GAPS is a big part. What kind of job you have is a big part. These are all full-timers. There's about a 4% to 5% gap that it can't explain.
Can't explain that little gap, Shu. Thank you so much. We are talking about why the gender pay gap for elite jobs is so high this hour. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about why the pay gap widens for women in elite jobs. And you can join the conversation. White-collar women, are you ready to go to your boss and demand a higher salary? Or have you accepted that men have an advantage? We're speaking this hour with Janet Adamy, news editor at The Wall Street Journal, and with Francine Blau, professor of industrial and labor relations and professor of economics at Cornell University. One comment from our website here. Ron says, my wife chose to give up her career to raise a family. My children and I benefited from her choice every day, so we were fine with losing her income, even though it was a little bit difficult at the beginning. Now that our kids are grown and my wife is considering reentering the workforce, we don't expect that employers will pay her the same as others who remained employed. That would be ludicrous, as would expecting employers to pay up for the benefit we derived from having her stay at home. As with most economic issues, we would all be better off if the government allowed the marketplace to work and individuals to exercise free choice rather than responding to pressure and trying to fix problems where none exist. Francine Blau, you wanted to talk about studies on discrimination against mothers specifically.
Yes. So I think very few people would argue with the idea that people who have a gap, you know, will have to pay likely some price for that. I would like to point out about that in terms of these examples that statistically overall, the gaps that women are taking are shorter and shorter, and actually gaps of, you know, I'm glad the individual caller was able to do it if she wanted to, but at gaps of 9 or 10 years, very unusual. We're talking more about 6 months and sometimes even less as more of a norm. But what I wanted to circle back to is that there are actually is important evidence that employers tend to discriminate against women who are mothers. So they did a randomized experiment where they sent identical resumes to employers, but it hinted in some cases that the women were mothers, and in other cases did not. And the employers were more eager to call back the mothers than the non-mothers than the mothers. So it may be because they anticipate these problems in the future, but I'd like to make the point that many mothers in the labor force have worked virtually full-time throughout and are very responsible employees and suffer from negative stereotypes that employers have about them.
So what do we do about that, Francine? How do you change that perception? What's the answer?
Well, one answer is that we do have to continue to enforce the anti-discrimination laws. But another answer is that we need to provide more supports to mothers so that women who do want to remain firmly attached to the labor force are better able to do so. And one very important thing there is access to high-quality child care. President Obama's proposal of universal pre-K would be very helpful in that regard. And interestingly, access to parental leave does help women to remain firmly attached to the labor force, because if parental leave is available and it's long enough so the woman can get her act together and get back into the labor force, then she does not have to sacrifice the job she's in. Whereas when it's not available, she may have to.
Let's get another call in here. Jim in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jim. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Nice job, by the way. I think you should negotiate for more money.
Thank you. Go ahead, Jim. Thanks.
My question is whether there's been a study that has observed the differential between women who are or are not head of household.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Janet, any answer to that? Are there substantial differences, any studies about that? Who is head of house, who is not?
Yeah, we do know from the MBA study that when men were taking breaks in their career, they were also suffering in a similar way that the women were taking. So I can let Professor Blau speak to some of the other research on that. But looking at it from a slightly different viewpoint, when the men were pulling back to spend more time with their kids and for family needs, they were also being penalized too.
Professor Blau?
Yes, I think that sounds reasonable. In general, if we look at female-headed families, those are families that face a variety of difficulties. And One is actually it's just very hard if you are a single parent of either sex to cover all the bases at home and at work.
Let's get Gavin in here from New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Gavin. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. So in this conversation, I'd kind of like to throw in the historical perspective.
Okay.
I'm a middle school social studies teacher who's now a stay-at-home dad, and my wife is an ER doctor. And I'm amazed, well, both jobs are very difficult and very demanding, but the way that doctors are compensated and respected is really, really so much higher than the way that teachers are respected. And I think maybe a lot of this has to do with the historical, you know, education was a female-dominated profession for so many years. Hmm. Versus doctors, you know, a male-dominated profession for so many years.
Indeed. Good point, Gavin. Thank you. Let's get to Janet in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Janet. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I wanted to point out an increasing naivete amongst young women. I had a college freshman tell me about 4 years ago that she would not mind making less money than a male counterpart because he would, of course, be the male, the primary breadwinner in his family, whereas she would not. And I told her, you know, to consider divorce, you know, disability and death as possibilities that could happen to her male spouse, leaving her family earning less than a co-worker's. She really said, she said, well, that's not common, you know, that's not typical or common. So it was very unnerving to me as an older feminist. So.
Janet, thank
you.
No, I appreciate your call. Thank you. We've got to wrap up here, Janet and Francine. I mean, there's a lot of attention being played to this right now. I'm looking at the business section from the Boston Globe just this weekend on the power of parity, the gender gap and pay here. There's a program in Boston, I know, offering women free workshops to help them with salary negotiations. Professor Blau, you first and then Janet, can you predict how long it might take for women to achieve parity with men in this arena?
Wow. No, that I don't make a prediction on that. But there are two elements to it. And one is when women who are equally qualified and present themselves in the labor market, when they will receive parity. And, you know, I hope as soon as possible, but I don't know when. And the other is to the extent that women and increasingly men take other choices to emphasize their family, et cetera, then, you know, we may continue to see gaps there, but hopefully we can make those as small as possible.
Janet Adamy, you get the last word on this.
Exactly. I think as the culture changes, that makes a big improvement, too.
Janet Adamy, news editor at the Wall Street Journal. Her great piece is Women in Elite Jobs Face Stubborn Pay Gap, and you can link to it at our website. Thanks so much, Janet. Really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure.
And Francine Blau, professor of industrial and labor relations and professor of economics at Cornell University. Thank you,
Thank
Professor.
You.
Great to have you.
Great to be here.
In a moment, women re-entering the workforce, new research on how women should talk about taking time off for their kids. This is On Point. Women returning to the workforce after taking care of kids often worry about what to do about those big gaps on their resumes. And employers worry about asking straightforward questions that might run up against government guidelines. Jennifer Chenal is a professor at Vanderbilt Law School. She's co-author of a big new study about how women should talk about that gap. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Jennifer joins me from New York. Hello, nice to have you.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
So describe your findings about women who have these gaps in their resumes because they took time off to take care of their children.
Well, we know that quite a few women do take time off to take care of their children. And we were very interested in what they should do when they want to come back to the workforce. Because we know that currently in the workforce, there is very much an atmosphere of family status ambiguity. And what I mean by that is the following. So, because of Equal Employment Opportunity Commission guidelines, employers are afraid to ask. about why a woman has a gap on her resume because they're afraid about running up against Title VII guidelines. And at the same time, employees may be concerned or scared to volunteer. They may be worried about confronting workplace norms. More importantly, most recruiting websites, career advice websites advising mothers returning back into the workforce actually discourage women from volunteering this information, from talking about why they have a resume gap. Mm. And so we designed an experiment to test whether hiding the reasons behind your resume gap was actually helping women get jobs or hurting women. And what unfortunately we found is that this popular advice to not talk about your child-related career gap may be more harmful for women than it is helpful.
So the statistics were striking, actually. Female candidates raised their chances of being hired they were 30 to 40 percentage points higher if they clarified their resume gaps and divulged more personal information.
That's correct. So the female candidates who didn't talk about their resume gap, who didn't provide an explanation, were dramatically less likely to be hired than the women who had an honest conversation about the reasons behind her resume gap.
You say the results are consistent with the theory in business, the ambiguity aversion, that unknown risks are better than known risks.
Well, it's actually the opposite.
The opposite, right.
Known risks are better than unknown risks. So this is a very well-known behavioral economics theory that individuals tend to prefer known risk over unknown risk. The interesting thing is that people have thought about this in financial context, but not really before in the employment context. And, you know, while the current EEOC guidance, which in many ways discourages employers and employees from having these honest conversations about family status and family status-related career gaps, unfortunately, it appears that the EEOC guidance may be having unintended negative consequences in these women who are trying to return to the workforce.
So talk more about that then, the EEOC guidelines, which say that employers should not ask about family matters. Then how do you handle it? If women are behind, if they don't talk about it, I mean, should this language be changed? I mean, how do you get around it?
Yeah, so we're absolutely advocating for a change in the EEOC guidance. So the EEOC guidance is exactly what it sounds like. It's a guidance to help employers avoid violating the Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prohibits sex discrimination in the workplace. That being said, it's not the law. And the EEOC, when they issued the guidance many years ago, were concerned that if employers asked about these questions, that they may be trying to discriminate against women and discriminate against mothers. But in fact, what we find, we know that the reality is that many women are mothers. Many women have family status related gaps in their resume or need accommodation in the workplace. And that's precisely what the model that we are advocating moving to is something that looks more like the model that we use for disabled employees. And that's the interactive process reasonable accommodation model. And the idea there is that starting at the interview stage, the employer and the employee have an honest conversation about what the employer's needs are in terms of when they need the employee there, what the job requires, but also that the employee have an honest conversation about when the employee can be there and what sort of family status related issues might be problematic or may need accommodating in the workplace.
Here's Carol Fishman Cohen, co-founder and CEO of iRelaunch, which helps women who've taken time off to raise kids return to the workforce, speaking at a TEDx event in Brookline, Massachusetts in January.
Returning to work after a career break is hard because of a disconnect between the employers and the relaunchers. Employers can view hiring people with a gap on their resume as a high-risk proposition, and individuals on career break can have doubts about their abilities to relaunch their careers, especially if they've been out for a long time.
And so what you're saying, Jennifer, is these open conversations between employers and employees lead to more meaningful change in the quality of applicants, especially in industries that really have been resistant to family-friendly work policies in the past.
That's right. So we know that that several industries, particularly financial industry, legal industry, have been very unaccommodating of women who need family-related accommodations in the workplace. And we think that increasing these honest conversations between employers and employees can help employers realize just how many women need this increased flexibility. And frankly, with the increased technology, technology is better, it's cheaper, it's easier than ever. Certainly not all jobs accommodate flexible working hours, flexible working location. But the fact of the matter is that many jobs do increasingly accommodate flexible working hours, flexible working location.
Got about a minute left here. I'm reading from your study. What employers need to do is stop seeing these work-family balance issues as something exceptional, because 80% of college-educated women are in the workforce and bear the majority of child care responsibilities, Jennifer.
That's correct. So, you know, we hear press all the time about there are more stay-at-home dads than ever. But the fact of the matter remains is that the majority of child care and family care-related responsibilities continues to fall on women. And the only way that we're going to see women advance long-term, catch up with men in the long-term, is that if we acknowledge this reality and make workplaces more family-friendly.
Jennifer Chennault is a professor at Vanderbilt Law School. She speaks with us from New York. Jennifer, thank you so much for your time and for your information.
Thank you for having me.
You can continue the conversation. Listeners, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, feminist icon Gloria Steinem on gender-based violence and the fight for equality around the world. Tom's back for that tomorrow. I'm Jane Clayson. Thanks for being with us. This is On Point.